happening tomorrow. There's a lot of news happening all around the world and right here at home. It's time to find out what's trending.
What's trending in Pierce County?
So just a week after the Seattle City Council passed this jobs-killing head tax, charging big businesses $275 per employee, Pierce County is getting in on the game. Except they're doing something awesome. They have decided to offer a $275 per employee tax credit to businesses that relocate in the Pierce County region. They're all in. Their Democrats and Republicans have gotten together and said, if you're unhappy with the business climate, the environment, the antagonism, the shaming, the demonizing, the vilifying, if you're sick of that in Seattle, come to Pierce County. Come to Tacoma. Come to Lakewood. Come to our neck of the woods. We're not going to mistreat you the way Seattle is. Bring your jobs here. We'll give you an employee tax credit. Last week, they kind of trolled the city of Seattle by putting up this video that basically said, we're not as demonic as Seattle. Now they're coming up with this plan. They're going to unveil the details later today. It's going to happen around 2 o'clock in Tacoma. So I don't know exactly all the particulars of the credit, how you would actually get the credit. I have to assume it has to do with bringing certain amount of jobs that at least pay family wages. But this is great. This is what I want to see. And this is kind of necessary. But it's necessary to do outside of this region. Because here's the deal. When you're talking to a kid who just graduates from UT Austin or from Princeton, from the University of Miami, wherever it is you're going, and you're trying to recruit them to work for you, and let's say you've got a business in Bothell or Tacoma or Redmond, likely you're telling them Seattle, right? That's what you're telling them. But if all of a sudden the Seattle brand is damaged, and it is, they're not going to want to move here. And you can try and say, hey, come and live in beautiful Tacoma. But where? What's where? They don't know what Tacoma is outside of this region, outside the Pacific Northwest. They don't. They should, but they don't. And so I think it behooves Pierce County City. It behooves every single city outside of Seattle to really step up their game to make sure that the Seattle stink doesn't get rubbed off on them, and that they can ultimately say, come to Tacoma, where our housing prices are low, but they're all modern, beautiful apartments. We've got great transportation, little traffic. Big businesses are coming here. They're investing here because this is the next big city for the state of Washington. Bellevue should do it. Everett should do it. Shoreline should do it. Bellingham should do it. Everyone should do it. Because Seattle is going to bring this entire region down, which is why you've got so many business leaders here, small and large, trying to push this referendum to overturn the head tax, because they know what this means. I have seen so many national publications just rip Seattle. And the Seattle City Council doesn't care. They don't care. They think they're in the right. They have moral authority, they believe. They just passed another tax, a property tax, on businesses and homeowners in one particular neighborhood of Seattle to pay for parks on the waterfront. They do not care. They are out of control. And people are starting to fight back, and it's not just businesses. It's everyday Seattleites who are sick and tired of what the city is becoming. Kudos to them. And speaking of that new tax, that brings us to the next story. Let's find out what else is trending.
What's trending in Seattle?
So they just passed a lid tax. A local improvement district tax. It's specifically to go after people they perceive as wealthy, businesses that they perceive as greedy, take more money from them in the form of a tax, and put it into green space. Because apparently when they decided to revitalize the Seattle waterfront, they didn't take into account budgets. And so now they need to make about $200 million from homeowners and businesses. Businesses that not only might get hit with its $275 an employee head tax, but now you're going to have them pay for ridiculous parks that you did not plan for. They're going to have a whole bunch of meetings, the city of Seattle. They're going to ignore you when you show up because that's what they do. They ignore people like this.
I say this sincerely. I would start to, regardless of what you do today, start to think about where we can find $200 million from another source because you're going to need it.
Because people are leaving. People don't want to pay this. We keep talking about how unaffordable it is in Seattle. These voices who complain that it's too expensive to live here, they're making it more expensive. These are the ones responsible. What do you think a tax on property does? It increases the cost, right? So how can you in one breath say, oh, we have a housing crisis, it's too unaffordable to live here, and then in the very next breath say, yay, I support this bill that increases the taxes, that increases the cost of living here. Oh, but the Friends of the Waterfront group, they support this. They say the funding is needed, even though they don't actually live in this area, so they're not going to be charged for it.
And the LID is a critical part of the overall funding structure to make this park a possibility. We at the Friends of the Waterfront are raising millions of dollars toward this effort.
Okay, good. Raise some more. You want it. This is on you. We don't need another park in Seattle. I'm told we need more housing. So if you want this park, if you want this amenity, why don't you pay for it? Let's find out what else is trending.
What's trending at home?
So finally, we have some more information on the cougar attack and specifically why the cougar attacked those two bicyclists, killing one, severely injuring the other in North Bend. And it makes total sense. Apparently, the cougar was emaciated, which means it was hungry. And maybe that's why it acted out in a way that's incredibly rare. Here's Captain Alan Myers with the Wildlife Foundation of Washington.
The fact that it stayed close proximity to these folks and attacked and stayed with them is highly, highly unusual.
It's highly unusual unless you're desperately hungry. And then all of a sudden, in a spot where people generally don't go, because this was really off track, it's off the traditional track in that region, the cougar sees two people that it views as food and decides to go after it. And this, while very rare, this is the first time in, I think it was a century, that we've had a cougar attack like this. It still leaves people like Jason Peebles, who's a hiker, talking to Cairo 7, leads him to carrying a gun with him.
No matter how you look at it, you need to have something when you're out in the woods because this is their territory. This is where they hunt. And so coming into their territory, you got to respect it and be prepared.
And yet, though, weirdly, at the same time, he says, we're in their home, we're in their territory, but we needed to kill it after the murder of this person, after the killing of this person. He says, well, once they taste human flesh, they keep going for it.
As soon as they kill somebody, a human, and they get that taste of blood, and they realize how easy it was to kill them, that becomes their target.
Okay. I get it. I just always feel a little bit uncomfortable when we're killing animals for doing what they're supposed to do, which is, you know, survive, and we're in their neck of the woods. Ultimately, obviously, I value human life way more than a cougar, but it is an interesting perspective here that we kind of ignore. But they're still doing this brain autopsy on the animal to see if something else was going on, but it seems like that, I don't know if that's necessary. He was hungry. And so he chose to use this human to satisfy that hunger. And it's a horrible tragedy. But that seems to be the indication here. I don't know how much more studies we have to do or how much more freaking out we need to do. So once in a century, one hungry, emaciated cougar kills. I don't know if that means we all got to be over the top concerned that this is going to happen again. Be aware. I just don't think you have to be crazy concerned. You're listening to The Jason Rancho, 1-800-465-8770. Welcome back to The Jason Rancho on AM 770, KTTH, and 94.5 FM on the Greater East Side. The Tumwater School Board is leaning into progressive social justice policies, and they're doing it in a big way. They're soon going to vote on an equity, diversion, and inclusion policy that defines race as a political construction to benefit white people. They define racism as something only white people can engage in. And that's angering some of the students at Tumwater Schools. In fact, one of them is Chad Turner. He is a senior from Black Hills High School, and he joins me now. Chad, good morning. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
So when did you first learn about this policy? Because it feels like when school boards do anything, generally speaking, the students don't really even notice.
Yeah, it was probably early last week. I was on the school website, and then I looked at the district website, and I saw this Race and Equity Act going to come through, and I said, oh, I've got to read this. And so I went and I read it, and I was pretty surprised at schools' lack of knowledge on their terms and definitions and the inconsistencies through the policy.
Well, what surprised you specifically?
Well, their lack of knowledge on the terms they were using, like race, they define as a political construct made up by white people, and racism, and pretty much all. And it didn't really specify what the policy did or where they plan on going with it.
Yeah, I was looking also at the definition of racism, and I was kind of blown away by the implications of this thing. And we've got it written up on our website, ktth.com, but they say racism is, quote, a complex system of beliefs and behaviors grounded in a presumed superiority of the white race. These beliefs and behaviors are conscious and unconscious, personal and institutional, and result in the oppression of people of color and benefit the dominant group, whites. A simpler definition of racial prejudice plus power equals racism. For you, why is that the incorrect way to define racism?
Well, first of all, if it was a political term, do they think that it started when our country was started, or did they think that people didn't realize that people had different skin colors and nationalities since the beginning of time? And the actual definition of racism is discrimination against any race, no matter who it is. Black people can discriminate against white people, and white people can discriminate against black people. It doesn't matter.
Has the school board reached out to students, to the best of your knowledge, as to whether or not they have the buy-in from the student body on a policy change like this?
Not to my knowledge. There is a meeting that a huge group of me and my friends are going to, and people from other schools in the district are coming to tonight, and then a school board meeting later this week.
So why do you feel called to get involved? Yes, it's a crazy social justice revision of words, but I suppose one could argue it's not going to directly impact you. They're just doing this so they can say they're doing it. Why are you so upset?
Well, schools are not supposed to take political stances on things. It's unconstitutional. And if they do say it's a political, race is a political thing, then why are they taking a stance on it? And this isn't the first incident we've had with the school district. They rearranged the entire schedule for the March for Our Lives so that students could participate in that. And it's really a recurring problem that it's not right. So someone's got to do something about it.
Are you politically conservative? Is that how you would identify?
Yes, I am.
Do you think the schools in Tumwater respect that position?
I would say no, because I feel really underrepresented in my conservative beliefs.
Where do your conservative beliefs come from? Because usually when we talk with, you know, 16, 17, 18-year-olds, they don't necessarily identify as conservative.
Yeah, I've really always been kind of politically active since I was younger, and then it just really interests me, and I'm going in political science next year, so.
Nice. Where are you going?
Samford University in Alabama.
Look at you. That's awesome. Congratulations.
Thank you.
So what do you hope happens at the meetings that are happening this week?
Well, I hope that the people who created this bill and want it to go through realize that this won't do anything and that their definitions are incorrect.
Do the schools there have a racial equity problem? The argument is that communities of color tend to be disciplined at higher rates, and this kind of policy to help ensure equity is necessary.
I really don't think it's a race issue. I just think that people act a certain way, and it doesn't have anything to do with race.
There you go. Again, I've been talking with Chad Turner. He's a senior from Black Hills High School. He is upset with the Tumwater School Board considering their new equity, diversion, and inclusion policy, which has some pretty progressive redefinitions of some basic words. It seems more like this is about propaganda. I've written about it on the website, ktth.com. If you send us a text with the keyword rants, R-A-N-T-Z, to the number 1-800-465-8770, you'll get a link to the article, plus a survey that the Tumwater School Board is asking people who live there to fill out with their response to the equity, diversion, and inclusion policy. It seems like Chad is not a fan. I think it's safe to say that. Chad, I appreciate you stopping by this morning. Sounds like you're at shop class, so I'm going to let you go back to that. Thank you so much for coming on, and best of luck. Tell us how the meetings go, okay?
I will, thanks.
Absolutely. Again, text the word RANTS, R-A-N-T-Z, to the number 1-800-465-8770. It's the None Better Tax Resolution Hotline. I'll go ahead and send you more information on this school board decision, pending school board decision by the Tumwater School Board. You're listening to The Jason Rant Show. Welcome back to the Jason Rant Show on AM 770, KTTH, and 94.5 FM in the Greater East Side. Tiny homes are controversial to some, necessary to others. But as the city of Seattle is installing them all across the city, one thing seems pretty damn clear. Most of us don't really know the rules associated with them. The Low Income Housing Institute's Board of Directors Vice President Melinda Nichols initiated the Tiny House program and has been the driving force behind it. And she joins me now. Thank you so much for coming on this morning.
I'm happy to be here. Thank you.
So just, if you could, give us a general 30-second elevator pitch on what tiny homes in these communities actually are.
Tiny homes are 8 by 12, which is pretty small, and they are built about from 15 per village to 50 per village. They provide temporary housing for homeless people, and the goal is for them to move on to permanent housing.
How many actually move on to permanent housing?
We've done some analysis, and in the last 2 years, 300 people have moved on to permanent housing.
What's the percentage?
That was a few months ago, so I don't know the percentage, but it's higher than you might think.
Okay, but just so we get a sense, it's 300 out of how many?
Well, we at that point probably had 125 tiny houses, so a pretty good, the majority of people have moved on.
And do you track them after they, because you said 300 people, so the math, I'm somewhat confused, but you're saying it's a higher than what we would likely think. Do you track them after they leave to make sure they don't end up in the same situation?
No, we do to some degree, and about 250 of them receive jobs also. And we do try to help, but our job as the Low-Income Housing Institute is to provide low-income housing.
Yeah.
And so we don't have that capability.
So what are the rules, generally speaking, for these communities? There are some that are low barrier, others that are not. So let's start with the non-low barrier communities.
The non-low barrier are referred to as clean and sober. And having alcohol or drugs on the site at all is not tolerated. So they're much stricter, and they... If you do utilize those and you are caught, you are terminated from the village.
How does one get into the non-low barrier? Take us through what you look at when someone wants to join one of these communities.
We at Lehigh are not the ones that make that decision. There are different people who manage the tiny house villages. Lehigh has been responsible for building a great number of them, but in terms of managing them, Lehigh manages some, but Nicholsville, Share, Wheel, which are all organizations that are operated and run by homeless people themselves, they also manage tiny house sites as well.
Is that a smart move?
They select people by whoever signs up first.
So why then, I suppose my question is, why would you associate what you guys do with the programs that are run by other homeless people? Because doesn't that suggest that they're not getting the help that's necessary if they're still living out on the streets? Wouldn't they be better served by someone who is not themselves homeless?
Well, it's an ironic situation, actually. Some of the best people to help homeless people are homeless themselves or have been. One of the really positive things that I've seen about the tiny house villages that are run by formerly homeless people is that it gives them a sense of self-esteem, mm-hmm. pride in themselves. And they often come into these villages broken. And one of the things that, as you know, helps all of us to feel better about ourselves is helping other people. And that's what that's one of the main things that I have noticed is how powerful that that community support is.
And, you know, I find myself on the fence now. And I used to be a big supporter of the tiny house community. But then what I don't like is this idea that, you know, professionals are not necessarily in charge. And I think, obviously, people are now turning to what happened in Ballard with Christopher Teal, who is accused of raping a woman in a bathroom stall. He's someone who had a warrant out for his arrest, and yet somehow he was able to live in one of these tiny house communities. How does that happen?
Well, I would guess I'd say a few things. Number one is that there are plenty of places that people live without having warrants checked on them. All over the city, all
should
over
they
the
be
state,
checked?
All over the country. Not necessarily. I mean, I don't know that rentals check whether you have a warrant out for your arrest. I guess what I'm saying is there may be another. I don't think that our standards should be that much different. And in terms of rape, at that, of course, we have rapes happen everywhere from red carpets to colleges. Okay. To every part of our entire, you know, universe. And it's hideous and horrendous wherever it happens. And it's appalling, as you can, you know, I totally support. But to say that because of it, that homeless villages are not acceptable, I think it's not fair.
Well, I'm not sure anyone's saying they're not acceptable, but I certainly take the position that when we're dealing with people who are living out on the streets, there tends to be a reason why they're living out on the streets. And so we should not treat them the same way we would someone who is trying to rent a high-end apartment who can prove that they can go through the background check and also hold down a job. I mean, if ultimately we want to go after the root causes of homelessness, it would appear that you should do a little bit more to find out if I'm subsidizing with taxpayer dollars and with land that's owned by the city, someone who has the capacity of committing a rape, and certainly someone who is skipping out on seeing a judge, that should be a red flag.
I can understand your concern. I think that I don't have the answer to all of these questions. My main goal is to put the villages together mm-hmm. and to build the houses. I'm a retired carpenter for 45 years. And so in terms of the way or the rules and regulations around them, I would nod off to the city of Seattle and to other organizations that have more experience than I do.
Just joining me, I'm talking with the Board of Directors Vice President for the Low Income Housing Institute, Melinda Nichols. She is the one who initiated the Tiny House Program and has been the driving force behind it. There is some controversy surrounding a low barrier tiny house village that up until about a week and a half ago, the city of Seattle said will happen and will be managed by Lehigh in the South Lake Union neighborhood. After many emails and phone calls and pressure, the city has indicated that it is not a certainty. Are they telling the truth?
Well, I don't know, but I would say that honestly, it's fine with me either way. We have 11,000 people that are homeless in King County. If they want to do different screening for different villages, I'm fine with it because I can't, you know, we can't put enough roofs over people's head fast enough to get people out from under bridges and in tents.
I just want to make sure they're not lying to folks, you know, because, you know, we want to be everyone to be held to account. So just if you could tell me.
I think that's a great question.
Right? Did the city contact you guys about this location because LIHI has confirmed some details, including this would be a low-barrier, tiny house village. So what did the city say to you guys when they talked to you about this project?
And then I would assume that that's what they said it was going to be. We don't make that call. They do. And I do really appreciate clean and sober housing. One of the things I like about it a lot is that you're protecting other people in the village itself that may be trying to stop drugs and alcohol use, and they don't need to have drugs and alcohol on the site to make a challenge to their attempt at sobriety. So I do appreciate the idea of clean and sober housing. But what Lehi does is help to identify potential sites, and we're basically under the direction of the city in doing what we're doing. And we do appreciate the new mayor being not just talking about it, but actually doing it.
Yeah, but they're doing it without talking to the community. And that, I think, is the problem, particularly in the South Lake Union neighborhood.
We need to talk to the community always.
So
I would agree with you.
So under the low barrier rules, you have to be seeking treatment for whatever addiction you have, but you can also have drug paraphernalia in your home?
That I'm very sorry. I don't know the exact rules about it. For me, I don't believe that any site should make something legal that's illegal. If people sell drugs on the site or anything like that, that's illegal.
And so why build tiny homes that are low barrier?
I will build tiny homes for any human being. And I'm not, I don't mean to siloize what I'm doing here, but my main focus is to actually get the buildings built. And I would also say that I'm not the driving force behind tiny houses. There are so many other people that are committed to doing this that sometimes when we do a call out for a build for tiny houses, 150 people show up. I've never seen anything quite like it because people like concrete work to do.
Mm-hmm.
They want to actually have a real solution to a real problem.
So my last question then for you is, do you support that idea that in order for a low barrier tent village or any tent villages before it goes up, should there be buy-in from the community? Should the neighborhood basically say, yes, we want it here?
I think that if we can get that, that's extremely important. And one of the things, I built tiny houses in a variety of neighborhoods all over the city. I've had neighbors come and bring us cookies. I've had neighbors come and build the tiny houses themselves. I've had neighbors come and say, we hate this. And so we do have different perspectives and different viewpoints from every neighborhood. And frankly, I think all of us get uncomfortable when there's any change in our neighborhood and there's anything that is different than what we've had before.
Well, when we invite drug users into individual neighborhoods, that's for me, because I live in this particular neighborhood. That's where I lose my ability to be open-minded on this. I don't think we should be doing that for people who are actively engaging in behavior that is ultimately going to kill them. And certainly in the short term, it's going to keep them out of actual housing long term. So from that perspective, if this was just a traditional tiny home, I'd have a significantly different position. But the fact that the city of Seattle hid this from us and took them very long time before they would even confirm whether or not a meeting was going to take place, which, by the way, it will be on May 31st, and I'll be showing up with a lot of folks. That's where, the red flags start to go up, that this may not be about what's best for everyone and maybe a little bit more symbolic. And I'll let you have the last word.
I respect your opinion and I respect your concern, and I want us to do the very best job we can. Tiny houses are not going to be the answer to 11,000 people not having homes in King County. They are one of the options that will help people in the short term. If we need to do this in a way that is more comfortable for the neighborhood, I think we need to listen to the neighborhood. I'm not opposed to what you're saying. What I'm trying to say is that I know that tiny houses work. I know that people who are on drugs and are addicted or are alcoholics and are out in a tent never stay there, and it's very difficult for them to ever get the help they need. Tiny houses put you in a place where you do get the resources that you need and you can move on with your life.
There you go. I've been talking with the Board of Directors Vice President Melinda Nichols of the Low Income Housing Institute. Melinda, I really appreciate you stopping by this morning.
Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate talking to you, and I respect your opinions, and I want to listen to everybody that has one, and let's get the best solution we can find.
Totally agree. And if you text the keyword homeless to 1-800-465-8770, we'll give you the opportunity to actually voice your concerns or your support by attending this meeting in Seattle on May 31st. I'll be there with a lot of listeners. I hope you guys will join me again. If you want more information, text the keyword homeless to 1-800-465-8770. You're listening to The Jason Rand Show. Now, time to get your work the right way with Right Way Traffic. Good morning, everybody. Welcome back to The Jason Rand Show, live in the Online Trading Academy studio. Don't forget, once the show is done, we continue chatting in the After Show podcast, which you can subscribe to at ktth.com or, of course, on iTunes or Stitcher, wherever it is you get your show, wherever it is you get your podcast. Just search for The Jason Rant Show. There, it's funny, tomorrow morning we're going to have on the air a business owner. He's a restaurateur. He owns a restaurant in West Seattle and a bar in Burien. And he was named to a list that activists are creating to boycott them. Why would they want to boycott this guy's business? Because he supports the referendum to overturn the Amazon head tax. And the head tax doesn't impact him directly. He's not paying the $275 a head. But you know who is? The vendors he buys from. Which means he's going to have to raise the prices of his menus, which will then lead, presumably, to either less customers or less profit for him. And he works in restaurants in an incredibly expensive city of Seattle, which means the amount of profit he actually makes, the profit margin, extremely low. And so I've been following the story. I actually have the blog up on our Facebook page at facebook.com/Jason Rants Show. If you can go there and help spread this story, I'd appreciate it. Because I reached out to the activists in the Seattle community who is talking about this boycott. Her name is Diane Rose Vincent. I sent her an email and I asked her if she could explain the boycott. Like, where is this boycott list? I'd like to report on it. And she said, there is no boycott list that I'm aware of. And I never said the word boycott. There really is no story there. Which is funny because I have a transcript. I have a screenshot of her comments on Facebook where she is asked, where is this boycott list? Her response, we're starting one. Three businesses we can ID so far that like the sponsored post, blah, 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 blah. We posted the actual transcript, the screenshot of the transcript. When I sent that back to her last night, I think I sent it around before I went to bed, so 6-ish, 6:30. She hasn't responded yet. She told me there's no story there. With respect, there is a big story there. Because that's what these folks do, these activists do. They try to bully and silence opposition. And sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. In this case, I don't think so, because the vast majority of people in Seattle, according to polling, suggest that they do not support the Amazon head tax, because it's not just an Amazon head tax. And even if it were, they wouldn't support it. The people here are against it. The people outside of the Seattle area are rightfully raising concerns about how the anti-business culture and environment in the city of Seattle, thanks to Mayor Jenny Durkin and the Seattle City Council, is impacting them. People are fighting back. We had Saul Spady on yesterday. He's the grandson of the founder of Dick's Drive-In. He's leading the cause to get this referendum to overturn the Amazon head tax. He's going to be live in studio on Thursday at 8:30 to talk about his support. I know a lot of you have actually asked how you can support the referendum. If you live in the city of Seattle, you should send me a text with the keyword head tax. It's one word, head tax, to the number 1-800-465-8770. We'll go ahead and send you over the information so you can sign the petition if you don't get the opportunity to see someone asking for signatures around the city of Seattle, because they need to get about 18,000 signatures, and they have until mid-June to do it. It's not going to be easy. And then before we go, just want to give you another reminder that we're doing. The Jason Rant Show is doing a road event next Thursday, May 31st, only we're not going to be broadcasting. I'm going to be showing up to a meeting that the city of Seattle is holding about a low barrier tent city, similar to what we just spoke to Michelle about. Is that her name? Melinda, excuse me.
There you go. Nichols.
It's an M name. I just spoke to Martin about this in the last segment. About the tent encampments and how the city of Seattle has been lying about their plans. And all of us have complained online, via text, via email. On this show, we've complained about how we don't want the city of Seattle to run itself even further into the ground. And even worse, we don't want the crazy policies of Seattle to impact everybody else who's listening. Those of you who live in Kent or Tukwila or Renton or Olympia or Tumwater or Bellevue or Shoreline and Linwood. We don't want them to impact everybody else, which is why it's so important for you to join me on May 31st. That's next Thursday in Seattle, in the South Lake Union neighborhood at 6 o'clock for this event. I've got all of the information online. Text me the keyword homeless to 1-800-465-8770. I'll get you the details. I'm bringing donuts, Top Pot donuts I'm bringing. And I'm not going to give it to anybody who doesn't show, who just shows up and isn't part of the fan base here. If you're a fan of the show, you'll ask me for a donut and you'll give me the keyword. You want to know what the keyword is?
What is it? May I have a donut, please?
Text the keyword homeless, 1-800-465-8770. 1-800-465-8770.